Thank you for this opportunity to get to lead us through this tonight. I've been looking forward to it. I was really looking forward to it until I realized that it was 4 chapters instead of 3 chapters, and it's a lot of stuff, y'all. So we have a lot of ground to cover, and many, many years to cover. So I hope that you're ready for a very broad sweep across Genesis 30 through 33. I just want to first tell you how I approach this study. I really like to deep dive whenever I prepare for presentations or things like that, but I didn't. I decided to just cover it broadly, and sometimes that can be as beneficial as the deep dives, especially when I deep dive. It may be more beneficial than a Lindsay deep dive. So I actually just read the Bible and looked at Dr. Darren Biles from the seminary. Is he still at the seminary? At some point, maybe he's still at the seminary. There's a website called preachingsource.com that I think the School of Preaching does at the seminary. And they have some really good outlines of books of the Bible. And so the Genesis is all outlined on there. And so I read through his outline several times. And a lot of it was really helpful for me in trying to cover this much. But I'm not going to preach tonight because I'm a woman. I'm just kidding. I'm not.
Preach it, Lindsay.
Yeah. Okay, so as we look at this text, which I hope that maybe some of y'all had time to look at over the past couple of days, we have a sweeping family drama, broken and unhealthy relationships, growth of the family and of flocks, deception, manipulation, but also God's faithfulness, reconciliation, and trust in the hope of God's promises. At the beginning of our study tonight in Genesis 30, we have two quarreling and divisive sisters and a passive, wayward Jacob. But at the end of our study tonight in Genesis 33, we have reconciled brothers and a faithful Israel. In between, we have beautiful pictures of God's faithfulness despite the strife and brokenness and his steadfast love for his people. So, let's get to it. Last time we were together, Gina ended her lesson with the last few verses of chapter 29, which is the start of the passage that we'll start with the birth of Leah's first 4 sons from Jacob. I probably should have named all the sons and really got into that, but again, I'm just trying to go over the top of it, and so I realize that a couple of these times I don't actually give you their names, but it's in there. It's there. So Gina pointed out to us with the first three, her first 3 sons, Leah was hoping with each of these children that her husband would come back to her and would hold her highly in his heart. Throughout these verses, when scripture states, when God saw, such as in Genesis 29:31, when God saw that Leah was hated or unloved, it does not indicate that God is just now realizing this. God's divine omniscience means that nothing escapes his attention. So when Leah was bringing her first 4 sons into the world, she declares that God had looked upon her affliction with Reuben in 32, and that God had heard her requests in verse 33 with her second birth. And her desperate hope with the birth of Levi was that Jacob would attach to her or possibly hold her highest in his heart. And finally, with the birth of Judah, she directed her praise and gratitude to God and then stopped bearing. This phrase at the end of 35 isn't clear as to whether she stopped bearing because Jacob was no longer giving his attention to her in order to dedicate that attention to Rachel, or if after trying, she was no longer becoming pregnant. But as we see later in chapter 30, is not because she has become barren. I don't know about y'all who heard Gina's lesson, but at the end, I knew what was coming in the next few verses, but I loved that the little bow wrapped up at the end of 29, that Leah struggled and struggled with her desires to have a fulfilling marriage with her husband, which despite her unique family situation is not an unreasonable desire, and finally gives her praise to God. However, we know that this is only the start of the sisterly feuds to come. So in chapter 30, which is our first chapter for tonight, it didn't hit me until a lot of things haven't hit me until we've studied it, until in previous readings, but the span of verses is short. It's like 30 verses, but it covers so many years. So this squabble, this strife between Rachel and Leah is not just a tiny squabble. Mm-hmm. Jacob's household was in strife for many years during the births of all these children. And these children grew up together, seeing bitterness and envy, manipulation and anger play out before their eyes on a daily basis by their mothers. And they were also witnessing a seemingly passive Jacob. Their father seems to just be going about his work and then doing as he's bidden by his wives without any complaints. There is no wonder that the children would one day grow up with seeds of bitterness and envy in their hearts toward their own brothers. But that's not for today. Can whoever has Genesis 31 through 2 read that?
When Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, she envied her sister. She said to Jacob, "Give me children, or I shall die." Jacob's anger was kindled against Rachel, and he said, "Am I in the place of God? Who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb?"
So, thank you. In verse 1, Rachel, in her desperation for children, demands children of her husband. Her response was quite envious, and it appears that the love of her husband was not enough for her. Her life's value revolved around her ability to bear children. Dr. Biles even suggests that maybe she was demanding that Jacob stop having relations with Leah so that she might have more opportunities to conceive. Jacob responds in anger, but we see that he is at least aware of her current inability to conceive. So she conceives of a plan to obtain children through a surrogate, her servant, Bilhah. With the first child birthed by Bilhah, Rachel perceives that God has weighed in and judged her case and given her a child. And with the second son, Rachel names him after the struggle that she's having with her sister, declaring that she has prevailed. This is likely because she has the most recent child, and not that math works backwards here. So far, Rachel has 4, Leah has 2. 2 through Bilhah. So notice again here in verse 9 that there is a when Leah saw. Previously at the beginning of chapter 30, there is when Rachel saw. And before that, in 29:31, it is when God saw. With the manipulation that is occurring between the sisters in chapter 30, it's as if the two of them are trying to play God in their households and bring about their own blessings by their own means. When Leah sees that Rachel has ceased bearing, she tries a similar strategy and convinces a willing Jacob to have children through her maid Zilpah. Her first son is named for her good fortune that has come, and then her next son, birthed by Zilpah, brings her happiness. Although we know that this is good fortune, and happiness didn't actually bring Leah what she desperately wanted. It only brought her back ahead of Rachel. In verses 14 through 24, Reuben is likely in his mid-teenage years, and he finds mandrakes in the field during the wheat harvest time. Rachel hears of this and asks Leah to give her some of the mandrakes that her son had found. But whoever has 30, verses 14 through 18, read that.
Okay. Now, in the days of wheat harvest, Reuben went and found mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother Leah. Then Rachel said to Leah, "Please give me some of your son's mandrakes." But she said to her, "Is it a small matter for you to take my husband? And would you take my son's mandrakes also?" So Rachel said, Therefore he may lie with you tonight in return for your son's mandrakes." When Jacob came in from the field in the evening, then Leah went out to meet him and said, "You must come in to me, for I have surely hired you with my son's mandrakes." So he lay with her that night, and God gave heed to Leah, and she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. Then Leah said, "God has given me my wages because I gave my maid to my husband." So she named him Issachar.
So Leah responds with resentment toward her sister and resists giving her the mandrakes. However, much like Esau back in Genesis 25, Rachel sees something precious for a meal, and like Esau, she'll regret this decision later. In verse 15, we see that it is Rachel who came up with a transaction of sexual attention for a meal. And again, Jacob willingly goes along. So in progression of the years of bringing forth children, the women go from desperate to God for children and the upper hand in their marriage situation, to rivaling each other for children and the attention of their shared husband, and finally to this cold transactional mode. Years of bitterness and strife will do that, do you? Either way, regardless of what the sisters thought that the mandrakes would do for their fertility, it was God who blessed them and remained faithful despite the years of bitterness. In verse 17, God listened to Leah and gave her children. And in verse 22, God remembered Rachel and listened to her and opened up her womb. God's grace on these sisters is remarkable. While on the surface, it may seem that the children of Jacob are the result of struggles and strategies and negotiations, the text is consistently clear that they are the result of God's blessing. So now that we've seen the growth of Jacob's family, we'll move through the verses on the growth of Jacob's flocks. So just to be honest, I don't very easily understand all these verses regarding Jacob's strategic manipulation of the flocks. So we'll probably move more quickly through the section than the previous. But before we move on, are there any comments on this first section of chapter 30 before we move on?
I was just really struck by the fact that God is so gracious. Mm-hmm. Even though his family is so dysfunctional.
Right.
You know, and it just gives me hope.
Yeah. I wrote that down somewhere, or either in my journal or in here, I'm not sure. But we have hope, you know, as crazy as our families are. That's what I've been, this feels like a show. Like you're watching these families.
So, yeah,
it does. And I'm like, oh, you know, Lord have grace on me too, please. All right.
The Friends episode, the one with the mandrakes.
All right. So in the next passage, the second half of chapter 30, verses 25-43, we see that Jacob desires to return to his home country with his family, and then Laban and Jacob negotiate wages for Jacob to continue serving Laban. And finally, there's this confusing section of Jacob's strategy to manipulate the arrangement in his favor. Not only do we see the parallels between the first half and the second half of this chapter of the growth of his family and the growth of his flocks, but also because there is similar progression. He has this desperate desire to move back home, and then you have the negotiations between Jacob and Laban, and then Jacob's strategic manipulation to get it by his own means. Despite the difficulty of the text regarding Jacob's crossbreeding of the stronger sheep to manipulate his agreement with Laban in his favor, the text implies the blessing of the Lord on Jacob in fulfillment of his promise. There's no reason why Jacob's strategy would have worked. At the start of this passage, Jacob wants to go back to his homeland and fulfill his request of the Lord and the promise from the Lord that he would indeed bring Jacob back. The promise of God is never in question in this passage. What is relevant is Jacob's willingness to trust God to fulfill his promise or try to manipulate God's promise for himself. Jacob details all that he has done for Laban and requests that he be let go to go back home. Laban doesn't question Jacob's service or his contention that he had fulfilled his obligation. Laban knows that the Lord has blessed him because of Jacob, and Laban basically offers him a blank check. He says, "Name your wages and I will give it," in verse 28. Jacob is determined, even after Laban offers a second time to give him what he wanted, to keep him there, he's determined to do the work himself. Jacob stated that he would go through and divide the flocks, but it seems that Laban did the actual removing himself, perhaps to prevent Jacob from falsely claiming them as his own. Laban divided the flock between his sons and Jacob. Laban's sons had the speckled and spotted, and Jacob had the non-speckled and spotted, and he trusted that the Lord would allow the speckled and spotted to be produced from the ones in his care, under his care. So in 37 through 42, we see that his strategy depended on the visual aids that he used. By putting a striped rod in front of the flocks that, as they mated, the assumption is that they would be more likely to produce striped or spotted flocks. Dr. Biles states, despite the peculiar strategy that Jacob employed, it seems clear in the text that the flocks were not blessed due to Jacob's strategy, but through the blessing of the Lord. Thus, like Abraham and Isaac before him, Jacob was blessed of God with great wealth. So, some things that we can learn from this passage are that our lives are designed to be blessings to others. Like, Laban recognized that God had blessed him because of Jacob. And that God in his goodness may choose to bless us in spite of ourselves. And he calls us to live our faith in the face of an unfaithful people. Okay, now chapter 31. Is anyone going to comment on his sheep and goat breeding?
Because that's the weirdest chapter ever.
It's extremely weird. Okay. So, overall in chapter 31, we have at the beginning, Jacob realizes, he recognizes that Laban's family has begun to despise him. And he convinces Rachel and Leah that it's time to leave. And they agree that there is no reason to stay. Jacob leaves without telling Laban, and Laban pursues Jacob, rebukes him for leaving, and accuses him of stealing his household idols. Laban searches for but does not find the idols, and Jacob responds in anger. At the end, Jacob and Laban make a covenant together. As God blessed Jacob with increased flocks, Laban's sons recognize that Jacob's gain came at their father's loss and began to despise Jacob. The passage starts with conflict but ends with a treaty. In the first part of the chapter, Jacob discusses why he wants to leave Laban. One, because Laban's sons have become jealous of him and angry. Two, because Laban's attitude is no longer friendly towards Jacob. And three, because the Lord instructed him to leave. And then he recounts to Rachel and Leah all of what happened with Laban in the previous chapter and why he thought they should leave, all the way through verse 15. Rachel and Leah tell him that the Lord had taken away from Laban, not Jacob, and they express their willingness to follow whatever the Lord directs him to do. Therefore, they leave, and like her husband told her brothers, took her brother's blessings. Rachel stole her father's idols. Bios states that this act affirms her feelings of entitlement to an inheritance from her father. What do you think? I mean, now that I wrote that and I say that out loud, I'm not sure how if that's a good analogy that can be made or comparison. Like her husband took, like Jacob stole Esau's blessings, Rachel stole her father's idols. Stealing, but.
Yeah, but I my understanding is it also represented the an inheritance.
Yeah, yeah.
So okay. I think probably in that sense, right, as an inheritance.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, because I read that and I thought, yeah, you're right. And then saying it out loud, you're right, that does make sense. Because she thought that it was entitlement to inherit. Yeah, okay. I'm sorry. Sorry for thinking that out loud right there. I just didn't want to move on with that in my head. Okay. In the conversation between Jacob and Laban, there are two cycles of conversation that they kind of do the same thing, where Laban speaks or acts, and then Jacob responds. And this happens in verses 25 through 42. The first part, Laban accuses Jacob of stealing and dealing foolishly and stating that while it's in his power to harm Jacob, God told him not to. And Jacob responds by saying that if something indeed was taken, then he should punish them. And in the second cycle, instead of speaking, Laban goes and searches for the idol, and then Jacob responds with accusatory questions and anger. There's a lot happening here, and this, in my mind, it's a prime example of a family with lots of pent-up anger and control and communication issues arguing, and but eventually coming to a resolution. And I feel like I'm watching this all play out. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Rachel again is deceptive when her father comes in to search for the idol in verse 35 and blames the way of women for not being able to rise and reveal the stolen idol. And I briefly searched for this, but is that ever resolved? I don't know if that's ever, she just takes them. Hmm. All right.
Was Laban supposed to be a believer? Was he?
Mm-hmm. You know.
I thought Rachel was.
So he says that God speaks to him. But one thing that I noticed that was interesting was, I didn't write down what verse it was, but whenever God, it says when God speaks to Laban, it's emphasized there, Laban the Aramean, there it is, in chapter 31, verse 24, but God came to Laban the Aramean in a dream by night, and I don't know, that just, to me, felt a little less of a personal relationship, and more of a God coming and speaking. Again, that I didn't, I'm not sure about that.
But plus he refers to God as the God of your father,
mm-hmm.
not
our father.
Right.
Yes, right.
Mm-hmm. He refers to him too as like the God of Abraham and Nahor, which is his, in his family. But, yeah. Okay. But then we have their covenant together at the end. Coming up. So Jacob interprets God's word to Laban as a rebuke, a message to Laban as a judgment and divine confirmation of Jacob's departure. He views Laban as defrauding him of payment, and he believes that God has seen the affliction of, Jacob believes that God has seen his affliction. So then Jacob and Laban enter their covenant, their new agreement. In verses 44 through the end of the chapter, detail this new covenant between them, including a stone set up as a pillar and a heap of stones as witnesses between them. Laban wanted the surety that Jacob would not harm his daughters or take other wives, and Jacob promised that neither of them would pass the heap and pillar to one another to do harm. And with that and the ceremonial sacrifice and dinner, the strife between them ended and Laban returned home. So Jacob was free. Not quite like the slavery that his future son would one day endure. He was held by another man to work unfairly for many years. But now he was going home, taking his wives, children, possessions, and the assurance of God's blessing with him. He doesn't get far before he experiences a divine reminder of the Lord's faithfulness to his word. But there's one thing standing between him and home, Esau. Now Jacob must prepare to meet the brother he deceived and the reason he left home, and one of the sources of their family's division. So, in chapter 32, we immediately read of this divine encounter. Can someone read 32, 1 through 2, whoever has that?
And Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's host." And he called the name of that place Mahanaim.
Thank you. So it's no coincidence that when Jacob was obedient to God's call to leave, the Lord reminded him of his presence. In Genesis 28, we also see that angels are another reminder of God's faithfulness to his promise to be with Jacob. Then immediately following this encounter, he was beginning to prepare for a meeting with Esau. Bible states that there's nothing in the text, in contrast to most commentaries on this passage, that obliges the conclusion that the actions of Jacob are out of a lack of faith, the actions coming up. Making a strategy doesn't necessarily suggest that his actions lacked faith. So let's read his strategy in verses 8 through 12 as he's preparing to meet Esau. Is it 8 through 12? Oh, I'm sorry. I just cannot see these words. Okay. It's 6 through 12. And the messengers returned to Jacob. No. Mm-mm.
That's right.
Is it 3 through 5?
I think that's right.
You think so?
Because it's the beginning of his fear.
Okay. Yeah, you're right. Okay. If Esau comes to the one camp and attacks it, then the camp that is left will escape. So, okay, I'm sorry. He sent the messengers to, and they came back and said that We came to your brother Esau, and he is coming to meet you, and there are 400 men with him. Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. He divided the people who were with him and the flocks and herds and camels into two camps, thinking, if Esau comes to the one camp and attacks it, then the camp that is left will escape. And Jacob said, O God of my father, Abraham, and God of my father, Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, return to your country and to your kindred that I may do you good. I am not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have shown to your servant. For with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now have become two camps. Please deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he may come and attack me, the mothers with the children. But you said, I will surely do you good, and make your offspring as sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. So perhaps the reminder of God's presence gave him courage to attempt to reconcile with his brother. His strategy is that Jacob initiates the contact with Esau, and he recognizes that his blessings are from the Lord and turns to the Lord in prayer, and he claimed God's promise of protection. Jacob here is a humble servant, and he has a request to find favor with Esau, and Esau responds that he is coming. Jacob's fear in verse 7 seems to be centered around Esau's accompanying army, but the fear has directed him to the Lord. So if we look at his prayer in verses 9 through 12, we see that Jacob reminded God that he was following God's instructions to return. He recognized that his blessings came from the Lord and that he was aware of his unworthiness of them. He pleaded with the Lord for protection, and he claimed God's promise of protection. So then Jacob prepares those who would carry the gift for Esau, and sends them on their way. And that night, he stays back in the camp. Jacob then took his family and everything that was left and sent them ahead of him so that he could spend the night alone. And that one night would change his life. Would whoever has Genesis 32:24-32, read that, please.
Then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the dawn of the day. Now when he saw that he did not rebel against him, he touched the socket of his hip, and the socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, let me go, for the day breaks. But he said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. So he said to him, what is your name? He said, Jacob. And he said, your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed. Then Jacob asked, saying, tell me your name, I pray. And he said, what is it that you ask about my name? And he blessed him there. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. Just as he crossed over Peniel, the sun rose on him, and he limped on his hip. Therefore, to this day, the children of Israel do not eat the muscle that shrank, which is on the hip socket, because he touched the socket of Jacob's hip in that muscle that shrank.
Thank you, Millie. So the text tells us of when Jacob becomes Israel. Much of Jacob's life to this point had been about wrestling. He wrestled with his brother for a birthright and a blessing. He wrestled with Laban for his family and wealth. And here he wrestled with God for a blessing much greater than the blessing he had stolen from Esau. This story also mirrors what will become the history of the nation of Israel, wrestling with God. It serves as a picture also of the struggle believers may endure to receive God's blessing. Bile states, Jacob's insistence to hold on serves as a model for believers through dark and lonely nights. In verses 24 through 25, the divine visitor, a man, Jacob thought at the time, who wrestled with him, he came and wrestled with him the whole night through. It's unclear if Jacob knew who it was with whom he wrestled all night. In verse 25, when it says, when the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, that again is not to mean that God was weak. It suggests the resilience of Jacob not to let go. Jacob, despite his injury and likely exhaustion, still seeks a blessing in verse 26. In verse 28, in a tradition that is rich in both testaments of changing names to reflect a new life's purpose. God changes Jacob's name to Israel. Jacob will no longer be known by the dubious nature of his earlier life, but by his wrestling with God. Jacob's new name cannot be separated from his limp. And I really liked this statement, that the shrinking of his muscle corresponded to the expanding of his faith. After encountering God, Jacob walked straighter with a limp than he walked before God touched him. So, chapter 33, after wrestling with God, Jacob awoke to the same reality as before. Esau was still coming. However, now Jacob's heart was changed, and he'd soon see that Esau's had changed as well. So when they finally meet, Jacob's fears were gone as he moved before his family, and that was out of his prepared plan, and Esau ran to meet him. So can whoever has Genesis 33:1-11 read that aloud?
And Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming, and 400 men with him. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two female servants, and he put the servants with their children in front, then Leah with her children, and Rachel and Joseph last of all. He himself went on before them, bowing himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. But Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. And when Esau lifted up his eyes and saw the women and children, he said, "Who are these with you?" Jacob said, "The children whom God has graciously given your servant." Then the servants drew near, they and their children, and bowed down. Leah likewise and her children drew near and bowed down. And last Joseph and Rachel drew near, and they bowed down. Esau said, "What do you mean by all this company that I meet?" Jacob answered, "To find favor in the sight of my Lord." But Esau said, "I have enough, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself." Jacob said, "No, please. If I have found favor in your sight, then accept my present from my hand. For I have seen your face, which is like seeing the face of God, and you have accepted me. Please accept my blessing that is brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough." Thus he urged him, and he took it.
Thank you. So we saw in verse 3 that Jacob changes the previous plan and crosses in front of his family. Before, the plan was for the family to meet Esau first and appease him with the gifts that Jacob, before Jacob arrived last. The hope was that the gifts would soften the heart of Esau. Now Jacob passes in front of his family and bows down to his brother. This was an act of humility. Although Isaac's blessing had meant that Esau would bow to Jacob, Jacob's bowing humbly before Esau does not undo the blessing, but demonstrates a changed heart in him. Dr. Biles states that bowing 7 times suggests that Jacob began bowing while Esau was some distance away, and the repetition demonstrated his sincerity. Esau runs to Jacob, they embrace, and they weep. I'm sure that neither of these men ever thought that this would happen, but such is the greatness of God's grace on his people. His steadfast love changes lives and humbles even the most proud and broken. They talk and catch up, as Esau had no idea that Jacob's family had grown so much, nor did Jacob know that Esau had amassed such a large army. Esau wanted to know what all of Jacob's company was for, and Jacob told him it was a gift. After Esau refused the gift, Jacob's response indicates that Esau's face likened to have seen the face of God, although Esau probably didn't know how significant that was, since Jacob professed to having actually seen the face of God the night before. In verse 11, Jacob asks Esau to take his blessing. In other verses before, this had been referred to his gift or present. And Biles states, in a poignant and unveiled reference to his own stealing of Esau's blessing, Jacob offers a peacemaking return of the blessing. For the next several verses, Esau offers Jacob traveling protection, to which Jacob politely declines, and because they expect to end up in the same destination at some point soon. Finally, we've come to the end of these chapters, but we can't miss the sweetness of God's faithfulness at the end. Can someone read verses 18 through 20?
Having thus come from Paddan Aram, Jacob arrived safely at the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, and he encamped in sight of the city. The plot of ground on which he had pitched his tent he bought for 100 pieces of bullion from the descendants of Hamor, the founder of Shechem. He set up a memorial stone there and invoked El, the God of Israel.
Thank you. So in verse 18, when it says, which is the land of Canaan, he came safely to the city, which is the land, the city of Shechem, which is the land of Canaan, is significant. The narrator is reminding us that God has fulfilled his promise to Jacob. Canaan is not just any city or stop on the way to the destination. It's the land that God promised to Abraham and his people. In verse 19, Jacob buys the parcel of land, and this is the first ownership of land in Canaan since Abraham purchased the burial plot for Sarah. Biles notes that this buying of land denotes that Jacob is buying into God's promise to him and to his family. And finally, in verse 20, Jacob builds an altar and remembers the one who blessed his journey and worshiped the Lord there. All right, so we've come a long way in the past few minutes. Through many years and many heartaches, we've seen some serious family drama, but we've also seen the reconciliation of the brothers, Jacob and Esau, and God's faithfulness to the promise that he made that will continue through the children of the sisters, Rachel and Leah. Israel bears the painful reminder that God is always with him, and his walk is straighter even with a limp. So that's what I have, and I would love to hear your thoughts on this passage, since we didn't really touch everything.
I think that Isaac was dead by the time Jacob and Esau meet this time, because he had lived 40 years past what he thought, you know, when he actually blessed Jacob instead of Esau. And that, I think Gina told us he lived 40 more years. I'm trying to figure out if 40 years has gone by the time these two meet up again.
I think them together.
I don't know
when that was.
Okay.
In August, but I think them together.
Okay. It would have been before.
California,
yeah. Yeah.
And of course, his mom was gone.
Yeah. I think that God touching his hip socket and him walking with a limp, having that reminder that he can't rely on his own cunning and strength the rest of his life, that he should rely on God, is a good reminder to us sometimes when things happen that we need to realize God is using it for our good and his glory, even though it seems like it may not be necessarily a good thing or beneficial in our eyes. That, I mean, I'm sure he probably didn't love walking with a limp the rest of his life, but it did draw him closer to God.
That reminded me a lot of in Psalm 119, there are multiple verses that talk, the psalmist talks about his affliction and how that brings him closer to the Lord multiple times. So, like, this is the first thing I thought of when we were reading it. This is my comfort and my affliction, that your promise gives me life. And it is good for me that I was afflicted, that I might learn your statutes. I know, O Lord, that your rules are righteous and that in faithfulness you have afflicted me. If your law had not been my delight, I would have perished in my affliction. He just talks about that over and over, and I think you can see that in Jacob's life too.
Verse 50.
Yeah.
This day is very good.
Isaac was still alive. He doesn't die until chapter 35.
Thank you.
Speaking of next week's episode.
Yeah, it must have brought him some joy. If his sons reconciled.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how do you think that Leah felt when, you know, here is the servant And then here's Leah and her family, and then here's Rachel and her family. You know, like last year we did the beginning of Genesis, where it really highlights God's character. But all throughout this, we just see God's character. It's like these people are a foil for God because they are just messed up, you know? And then we see sparks of faithfulness, but what we really see is God keeping his promise, keeping his covenant promise throughout all of this, and working in these people so that they are faithful to the covenant. I mean, whether he has to wrestle with an actual angel, you know, all these just divine interventions where he closes up wombs and opens wombs and this whole, you know, messed up family thing. And God is faithful to keep his covenant promise so that his providence, his plan, can move on. And I think we'll see that as we get into, you know, Joseph more too, of course, God's providence with Joseph. But I think that these people are, you know, as we're kind of ending this patriarchal period, these people are a really great foil for continuing our look at God's character.
So I wonder if Rachel's insistence that her husband gave her children had anything to do with he had this great ability to grow his flocks and herds. If he can do all of that, why can't you give me a child? Yeah. Do we need a strict?
Definitely. It was painful to think about. Usually, you know, I read that chapter and then move on. I'm like, yeah, they had problems, but they had problems for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And the children were there. And it doesn't say, I mean, the servants, they probably weren't just not, you know, feeling anything. They probably had issues too, you know? I mean, that's, I don't know, you know, the culture for servants in this period. If this was happened a lot, or if this how that worked, but
well, they're still humans, though.
Exactly. You know? Exactly.
Get an idea with Hagar and Sarah.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm.
And the boldness to go out and say, "I've bought you," you know. Wow, that it goes from pleading with God that he would come to her and choose her, and then at the end going out and saying, "I bought you."
Desperate.
Yeah, it was really sad to read.
That's such a good point, too, that like they're set up to be envious from what they've seen. Mm-hmm. This like pattern after pattern in the family, like repeating, but I've never thought about that with his brothers and Joseph and then like what they saw.
Right.
Telling, I mean, it's human anyway to be envious, but that was like their front and center their whole life. So. Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't like there were two or three of them to be envious, there were 12 of
them.
Mm-hmm. This compounds it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Highlights how much our children learn from our example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then it makes you wonder, did those children of the servant, did they look to that servant as a mother? Or did they look to Leah? That would be confusing, wouldn't it? Yeah.
It seems like from the text that they're like Leah and Rachel are their mothers. I can't imagine how that feels as a servant.
No.
And they probably also nursed those babies. Like, the serpents probably nursed them. Mm-hmm. It's really tough.
I thought the 12 tribes, right? You hear like the 12 tribes, and I was like, oh, there's 12 people. And you're like, that's nice. But you know, like that's how it happened. It's just, it's interesting, like the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the 12 tribes of Israel, and it, you know.
It makes it sound like they're all just one big group of happy patriarchs.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But yeah, it highlights the point you were making. Like, it's God's faithfulness because it, you know, brought anything good out of all of this. And they're foundational. Like, they're the foundation, but it's because of God, not them.
Yeah.
That's something to think about, the reconciliation being another pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph and his brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And how he kind of stopped that pattern through his understanding was in all of it and didn't blame them. Just like in a way, we saw that he blamed Jacob.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is striking how Esau was so forgiving. You have to wonder what, I mean, out of him came the Edomites, and they were not friendly towards God's people, we see later. But here he's at, I mean, but he clearly grew up in a household of some sort of faith. So I wonder what his religious worldview or whatever,
mm-hmm.
you know, what that was. That he responded like this. But did he believe? I don't know. I mean,
yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah. I can't remember if it was a text that. Not that an unbeliever can't be forgiving, but
well, next time we meet, you're gonna open up the Joseph story.
Yeah, so we're, it's a good thing we noted that Isaac died and all that, because we're starting in with Joseph next time.
Mm-hmm. Were you gonna say something very long?
I was just gonna say it's so interesting that Esau ran to him.
Yeah, I was thinking in, I think it was a, was it with Abraham where he was going to give one of the men of the village something, and the guy was saying, oh no, you don't need to, even, you know, even though it's worth, he was kind of like hinting, and so Abraham or whoever it was gave it to him. In this case, Esau's saying, no, you don't need to give that to me. But it doesn't seem to indicate that Jacob felt like Esau was being fake, mm-hmm. like he expected. It seems mm-hmm. like Esau was sincerely mm-hmm. saying, I don't need this of you, I don't expect this. But Jacob still really wanted to give it sincerely.
So you think it was like a peace offering? In a sense?
I mean, I would think so.
Between since, brothers?
Since he was originally leading out with that.
Mm-hmm.
When I was reading what Dr. Biles has said on this chapter, he said that, you know, what you see missing is that, yes, there's reconciliation, but we don't see where Jacob repented, you know, to his brother or of that. But his heart was changed.
Well, and there's, like, so many instances of, like, people crossing their hands and giving the blessing, and, like, somebody getting the blessing who isn't supposed to in the line. It just makes me wonder, like, if, like, Jacob was, I think, intended to get that blessing, the blessing that he got.
Mm-hmm.
But he probably, like, didn't need to finagle for it, because other people didn't finagle for it. But I think when he says, I don't deserve any of the blessings that I got, I think that that's huge mm-hmm. for him in... Like, instead of like, oh, I could just have this because I can trick my way into it. Mm-hmm. It's not even about that anymore. It's like an undeserved, right, grace.
Right. Yeah.
So, and Esau was like giving stuff away. I mean, his heart wasn't right to get that particular blessing to bless everyone. Mm-hmm. So,
exactly, yeah.
Maybe he was right realizing things too over all those years.
Well, I just wondered, you know, when he heard his dad tell Jacob, you are not to marry the women of, you know, and Esau heard that and decided, I'm going to go out and marry some more of those women. I mean, I wonder at some point he realized, okay, spiting my parents and doing what they said not to has not brought me joy, made me happy.
Yeah.
And here's my brother who has obeyed. And look how God's prospered him.
Mm-hmm. I have a book called Given, and it's about the meaning and practice of biblical blessing. It was written by a woman who served in Turkey for about 15 years. But it's a new book. Anyway, it's really good. And she talks a lot about Jacob and the theme of blessing in Genesis and stuff. So I'll have to make like some copies of some of those pages and bring them next time for you guys, because she has some really good things to say. And I forgot. I was going to, and I forgot. But that might be a book at some point.
We could go somewhere about that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's fantastic. It's really good. Yeah. Her and her husband were with the IMB for 15 years in Turkey. Now they're in Louisiana. So.
Yeah, I think it's hard for us as Western modern Americans to understand the blessing culture and all of it's the implications of what's going
and
on here.
She talks about it. She really does somewhat of a systematic theology of biblical blessing throughout Genesis to Revelation, but she fills it also with some personal stories of her time in Turkey, because blessing is such an important part of culture there, and in Central Asia, just all over it is, and also some church history stuff she includes, so it's really fantastic.
What's her name?
Tina Bosch.
Yeah.
Ken Hemphill, he was a president at Southwestern at one point, I don't know how many years ago, is her dad.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Yeah.
Lindsay, you did a wonderful job.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
That was fantastic.
I enjoyed reading it. I didn't enjoy the Rachel and Leah part very much, but I enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, look at her.
Thank you.